demonstrating the untruth of these utopias, right? The increase in the internet, right, has not resulted in a wildly self-organized, you know, anti-government, anti-capitalist freedom, right? It's resulted in, you know, pretty sophisticated mechanisms of control and precisely self-control exactly along the lines that Tocqueville's pointing out. So that's one thing, right? I want to be naively optimistic, right? On the other hand, I want to be deeply, deeply, deeply cynical, and probably more cynical than Tocqueville. Because what I want to do is look at what second-order cybernetics, right? And this is this cybernetics that comes after the sort of, you know, classical 1940s, 1950s era of cybernetics. I want to look at how it starts to relate to noise, right? And a lot of the ways it starts to relate to noise, right, are much different from the way that Tocqueville's account, right? Tocqueville's account says cybernetics hates noise. It wants to get rid of noise. It wants to get rid of fluctuation. It wants order. It wants stability, so on and so forth, right? And actually, not entirely the case. Okay. So what's going on here? Well, one of the things, one of the sort of crucial historical pieces to try and get a sense of this kind of, this history of, say, scientific experimentation into sort of utopian social experimentation, right? We might say, like, well, how the hell is that possible if everybody was working under DOD money, right? Because everybody was, right? I mean, that's, if you look at cybernetics, if you look especially up into, you know, up until around, like, 1970, maybe a little later, you know, everybody who's doing this kind of cybernetics work is doing it being paid by the Navy, being paid by the Air Force, being paid by the OSS, whatever, right? And there's actually a crucial, crucial, crucial piece of legislation, right, if you want to do the history of this period that you have to come to grips with, right? And that's what's called the Mansfield Amendment. And essentially, and what happens is that a sort of, I want to say it's 72 now, I'm not sure. But it's in the middle of all this kind of distrust of the military-industrial complex, this distrust of the Vietnam War, right, the efforts that are being made against that, the sort of critique of academic military funding of academic research, that what's called the Mansfield Agreement gets introduced. And what it does is it says, you can't get defense research unless you're doing things that have defense applications. Right? So it's meant as a kind of, it's a very weird kind of piece of legislation to see like why this came into play. On the one hand, it's meant to sort of insulate universities from criticism of being involved with the military-industrial complex. On the other hand, it's also meant to sort of rein in some of the experiments that have been going on using DOD funding. Right? And chief among these was a place called the Biological Computer Laboratory. This is a place out in Urbana in Illinois. And this is basically the center for the study of self-organization. Right? This is Heinz von Foster, who was a German immigre, who was part of the Macy conferences. Basically creates this institute that is really looking at self-organization, looking at this turn towards reflexivity, right? Will attract people like Stafford Beer, another English crazy guy who wore bow ties and had a beard. It's called Gordon Pass. Ashby, who we saw earlier, who's responsible for this law of requisite variety, will come there, as well as a whole other cast of really interesting folks, right? And a lot of what they'll be doing is thinking about these kind of questions of like, well, who regulates the regulators, right? What is the goal of regulation? And really questioning these things at a really kind of fundamental level, right? So they're looking at self-organizing systems, right? And initially, these are emergent behaviors, right? These are adaptive learning. These are, you know, spontaneous order in biological systems that can be modeled in a computer. This is, you know, how do we make the anti-aircraft go and shoot down the enemy, you know, even better, right? But it very, very quickly spins, you know, using this DOD funding, right, very quickly spins out of control. Right? And they start thinking about pedagogy, they start thinking about communication, they start thinking about how self-organizing social systems are really about novelty and creativity, right? Rather than strictly about, like, this is a noisy channel and we need to make it non-noisy. And so this is really interesting, right? And there's all sorts of really kind of crazy, you know, pushes that happen here that kind of, you know, really interesting initiatives, right? So they go to Mexico, to basically Ivan Illich has like an autonomous kind of seminar going on in Mexico under like vaguely theological auspices, or it's like a theological school to teach people languages, but actually it turns out to be this kind of weird, kind of like very critical left think tank in the middle of Mexico called, it's at, is it Cuerverna, I think is the name of it. It's usually, the abbreviation of it is CIDOC, C-I-D-O-C. And they go, a bunch of people from the Urbana Biological Computer Laboratory wind up going there, right? So there is this kind of real, you know, I mean, if we have to believe that Ivan Illich, right, is complicit with the cybernetic control system, right, then I think we're like, there's no point at that point, right? But, you know, that's a level of, like, the embeddedness of control within discourse that I'm not willing to sort of to countenance. Right, so it becomes this kind of alternative way of thinking about self-transparency, right? And it's not a self-transparency in the Kuhn way, which is, you know, like about kind of a reading off of qualities, right? Of reporting your qualities to your superior within the system, so that your qualities can be, you know, registered, divided, you know, portioned out, so on and so forth. But really, it's about inventing questions. It's about thinking about the systems that you're part of and thinking about how you want to change them. And a lot of the work that, say, Heinz von Foster will do when he comes back from Mexico will be along these lines. Right? He'll be working on a number of projects that will basically have these, like, basically taking courses that are actually student, like, the students kind of agitate for him to teach these courses. And they're officially listed in the course catalog as, you know, heuristics courses. Right? But they turn out to be these, like, wildly unrepeatable, unpredictable collaborative seminars. Right? And one of them they basically result in the production of books. So there's a book that's produced called The Whole University Catalog, right, coming off of The Whole Earth Catalog, which is this kind of critical look at the University of Illinois and sort of people, like, sort of thinking about ways to think about the system that they're working within. There will be an ecological source book that'll be produced that, like, seems very current with a lot of kind of really interesting ecological work that's being done, both in terms of, you know, having scientific stuff, but also having kind of, like, practical stuff that one would do in your everyday life. And then there's also this really amazing book they produced called The Cybernetics of Cybernetics, right? And this is where you get this whole kind of, like, second-order cybernetics, right? It's a cybernetics that's, you know, applying itself to itself, and what's happening is not just another level of regulation, but something kind of becoming a little more bizarre. So you'll get this really amazing... this book has been described as, like, hypertext, you know, way before its time. It has, like, there's multiple books attached to it. There's, like, books. There's a meta book that pulls out that has, like, a sort of conceptual graph of all the ideas within the book. There's a crazy navigation system where you punch holes in the side according to a series of marks in the side, and then you stick a pen through it, right? And then the pen will land you on, like, if you're on a given page and you stick a pen through certain holes, it'll take you to another page, right? And this is to me a kind of... There's something really interesting and creative about this that seems to be escaping just this kind of, like, we need to tie everything together into a system, right? And a lot of the work they do is related to this, right? So people at Urbana are working on Plato. Plato was one of the first sort of computer networks that allowed people to do sort of communication over a computer network. It's kind of parallel to the ARPANET. It's like a different research network. And there are people who are doing, like, political science, political psychology on this. And rather than doing the sort of study questions that they were supposed to, they kind of hijack the system to have a discussion about whether or not they should impeach Nixon, right? This actually gets that aspect of the project shut down, right? But it's this kind of, you know, there's definitely these kind of tensions going on. Now, all these tensions basically get wiped out when the Mansfeld Amendment gets passed, right? It basically says, like, okay, you've got, you know, if it's not DOD, if it's not, you know, if it's not totally... obviously military or going to lead to military uses, then you can't have it funded, right? And so basically their funding goes away and the institute kind of dissolves. And it's not the case, however, with, say, artificial intelligence, right? If you look at the split between, say, cybernetics and artificial intelligence, we're always, you know, symbolic AI and cybernetics, we're always kind of at each other's throats and always trying to occupy the same space. A lot of the AI research basically did not make this kind of principle stand and say, like, well, if it has to be military focused, in the end, I won't do it. I mean, that's basically what Heinz von Foster does. A lot of symbolic AI says, like, okay, there's money, sure, whatever. So it's an interesting moment. But anyway, to get back to this whole question of what's going on here, a lot of the ideas that come out of the Biological Computer Laboratory, and in particular through the work of somebody by the name of Herbert Bruhn, who's an avant-garde musical composer who's working with the BCL. Right, so the BCL is very, very interdisciplinary. You know, you've got the sort of student counterculture hanging out with the German emigre ex-physicists who now prefer to hang out with Ivan Illich and think about how to reinvent pedagogy, hanging out with the crazy electronic music pioneers, right? And it's a really kind of interesting environment. Herbert Brun basically comes up with an idea that basically he kind of reacts against communication, right? And basically says, like, what we get out of second-order cybernetics is not something that's about communication or control, but actually what we get is a vision of what he calls anti-communication, right? And this is this idea that basically language as a kind of coding system, right, as something that expresses a pre-given quality, right, is actually inadequate to the task of the actual experiences or encounters that people should be having in social life, right? And so here's his definition of anti-communication. As this is the point where the arts, including music, come in, let me formulate a useful term. Where a new thought is presented, the speaker's problem is not any longer only a problem in communication, a problem in communication, but one of communication. My useful term is introduced thus. A speaker with a new thought has to solve a problem of anti-communication. The syllables anti are used here as an antipodes, antiphony, antithesis, not meaning hostile or against, but rather juxtaposed or from the other side. Anti-communication faces communication somewhat as an offspring faces the progenitor. And just as the offspring eventually will in turn become a progenitor, so will anti-communication in turn become communication. Right? So the idea, and he goes on a little later, and he says, anti-communication is an attempt at saying something, not a refusal to say it. Communication is achievable by learning from language how to say something. Anti-communication is an attempt at respectfully teaching language to say it. Right? So there's a kind of interesting model here for a kind of a way in which people are going to interact, right? That I think has a lot, you know, I think I can hear echoes here of the kind of cocoon picture of the way forms of life are supposed to butt up against each other, right? And what kind of modes of composition are possible here, right? And it's not about extracting qualities, right? Extracting states of the situation, composing them in some sort of, you know, regulatory apparatus that reaches consensus, right? But it's about a creative, unpredictable encounter, right? But at the same time, this is a kind of philosophy of this philosophy of anti-communication is embedded exactly within this kind of wild second-order cybernetic utopianism, right? This is from a quote. This quote that I was reading from is from a speech called "Technology and the Composer," where basically it's this kind of wild scheme for basically putting computer scientists and avant-garde music composers in charge of like charting the course of world civilization, right? That he actually delivers in all seriousness to a UNESCO meeting in 1970 in Stockholm. So it's really worth a read because you're like, this is not quite what's going on with this kind of vision of cybernetics as this kind of drab, dreary sort of system of total control. So that's, unfortunately, they didn't actually go for this. So, in case you were wondering.
Yeah. I actually have to sit down.
Okay.
I wanted to say thanks and thanks to everybody. And if anyone wants to follow up on email, definitely feel free. So, good luck with this. Bye.
So that's one thing, right? Is to say, like, okay, look, there is a utopianism in second order cybernetics that we might not want to throw away as quickly as Cocoon does, right? Yep. At the same time, I think it's important to sort of think about what the theoretical foundations of second-order cybernetics were, because it's something that Cocoon doesn't really get into. And when you actually do look into that, you also get a picture of a, you know, kind of Cocoon-like, very scary critique that kind of goes beyond what they're talking about. And this is this idea of noise and how it is that the sort of self-organizing system relates to noise. Cocoon says, the cybernetic hypothesis corresponds consequently to a desire for order and certitude, both the natural and social sciences. Now, second-order cybernetics actually is going to take noise, uncertainty, novelty, creativity as its object, right? So it's not about control, right? It is about something like emergence, right? Or about this kind of dynamic that isn't pre-specified in a sort of teleologically designed regulatory apparatus. And what's interesting is how second-order cybernetics gets there, right? They start off from thinking about this idea, and actually Ashby, who we saw with the very crazy hat earlier, had this law of requisite variety, right? That you only had that basically you only got out of a system what you put into it, in very precise mathematical terms. And he used this basically to argue that self-organization was impossible, right? So this is at one of the first meetings on self-organization. He gets up and he's like, actually, there's no such thing. And he says, basically, look, either the change comes from an external source, right? You know, there's a change in the system, the behavior of the system changes for the better. Well, then either that happens from the outside, right, in which case it's not self-organization, or B, the system is pre-programmed to change in that kind of way, right? That the adaptation is just a trick. It's not actually an event of something actually changing, right? And so he says, look, there's no such thing as self-organization. And that's where, that's the challenge that's thrown down. And the answer to that is what kind of defines second order, this particular, you know, Illinois, middle of the cornfield school of second order cybernetics. And that's this idea of order from noise. Right? Because the question that Ashby is saying is like, well, look, where does the system get the variety that it needs to self-organize? If it doesn't already contain that variety, right, if it doesn't already have the capacity to be in that state that's better, you know, or in the range of states that are better given the potential range of environmental inputs, where is it going to get that from, right? And the answer that Heinz von Foster, among other people, give is from noise, right? That instead of being destructive, right, instead of looking at noise as something that's exclusively to be eliminated, it's something that, you know, is this kind of necessary but unfortunate, you know, thing that's always making communication less transparent, making control less effective. Actually, noise, so this random, unpredictable, you know, kind of erupting sequence of events actually becomes the source that the system needs to be able to modify its own behavior, right? The system literally can feed on noise, can actually feed on the unpredictable in order to sort of modify its behavior, right? To sort of, you know, to sort of change its behavior up to try different kinds of solutions and see which of those solutions is actually going to be effective, right? And that's, so when we say, you know, we see Tikkun, sort of, they valorize noise, right? They say a behavior that escapes control while remaining indifferent to the system is called noise, which consequently cannot be handled by a binary machine reduced to a zero or a one. Such noises are the lines of flight, the wanderings of desire that have still not gone back into the valorization circuit, the non-enrolled, right? And that sounds really good, right? You're like, go noise, right? But actually, what people are doing starting in the 1950s and going into the 60s and 70s is actually looking at how systems need to care for noise. Systems need to cultivate noise in order to maintain a kind of adaptive margin, right? And so I think we can see, you know, we can connect this up to theories of, you know, if we look at, say, like what happens in Chile, right? We look at this disruption that allows a restructuring, right? We could think about that in terms of noise, right? We can think about the way in which a certain kind of neoliberal model of control actually wants to have noise, wants to have chaos, right? And that's one thing, I think that's something that we're thinking about here, right? That there's a possibility that cybernetics, right, is not exclusively about control, right? That there is this kind of, internal to cybernetics, a sort of discourse of noise as a positive force, of disruption, of novelty, right? And on the one hand, this is something that like points towards a kind of alternative utopian horizon that we might still be inspired by, even though it seems very distant. Right? But on the other hand, when you think about like, well, what's the sort of regime of exploitation that's going to base itself on second order cybernetics, right? And that's going to be different from the one that Tikkun is describing, right? So when they say here, you know, they say, and this I'll just end here in section 8, they say defeating the process of cybernetization, toppling the empire, will take place through opening up a breach for panic, because the empire is an ensemble of devices that aim to ward off all events. A process of control and rationalization, its fall will be perceived by its agents and its control apparatus as the most irrational of phenomena. Right? So there's a couple of things here, right? I mean, on the one hand, is empire actually threatened by irrationality and panic? Right? Is a kind of cumulative, self-reinforcing agglomeration of panic and crisis and irrationality something that is external to empire? I mean, I think, if anything, you know, if we look at the last 10 years, right, if we look at the last 10 years since this text was written, we would say no, right? We've seen political terror, right, political panic, being mobilized in all sorts of ways to reinforce global control, especially, you know, this event, right, this event that changes things, right, the disruption, the noise. We also see irrationality and panic within the financial sphere, right, being used precisely as something that is restructuring the financial sphere along less and less egalitarian lines, right? So I think this idea that somehow empire is all about things functioning smoothly, right, is something that's actually not borne out by the past decade of history. But I also think that if empire is really undergirded by cybernetics, right, if cybernetics ultimately forms the sort of core of how empire, you know, the sort of police thought of empire, right, as they call it somewhere in here, right, it should know better than to ward off all events, right? This idea that empire should be this, you know, is threatened by the event, actually, that's a very, very kind of first-order cybernetic vision of empire, right? And if we're thinking about empire as subtle, if we're thinking about empire as adaptive, if we're thinking about empire as able to modify itself to sort of persist in its own identity, right, then it needs to actually incorporate events and incorporate noise into its own kind of process of self-organization. So that's, you know, on the one hand, we get a very much more cynical view of what the potential control strategies can be. On the other hand, this maybe opens us up into some more concrete utopian sort of territory. But that's, I have no idea how to put those two ideas together. So if anybody does, I'd love to hear it. Anybody?